Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Steve Hodges. He is the author of a new book titled It's No Accident. The book addresses a silent epidemic in America that is causing exhaustion, distress, and lingering medical problems for millions of children and their families. Dr. Steve and I will be discussing about breakthrough solutions to your child's wetting, constipation, urinary tract infections, and other potty problems. Good morning, Dr. Steve. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Doing great. Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Your book is very interesting read. It is very thorough and very well written. It's No Accident is a must read for all parents and caregivers. So congratulations.
Oh, thanks so much.
Let's start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, sure. I was born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I'm the child of Greek immigrants, and went to Duke University undergrad, and there I majored in classical studies, some Greek history there, and then I went to medical school at Wake Forest University. When I graduated Wake Forest, I went to a residency in urology, which is a five-year program of general urology, and then did a three-year fellowship in pediatric urology, one of those years at the Children's Hospital in San Diego, affiliated with the Navy, and then 2 years in the lab back at Wake Forest. And then when I was back at Wake Forest, I joined on after my research years on faculty, and I've been there in faculty since 2006, practicing primarily pediatric urology.
Wonderful. Why did you write It's No Accident?
So, yeah, it's very interesting. And, you know, it's funny because I just finished a clinic this morning and I saw three more examples of why I wrote the book. And parents will come in and they'll have a new, basically some kind of potty problem with their child, you know, bedwetting, daytime wetting, infections. And they would have no clue, you know, what caused these problems. There's very little information out there online or readily available for the lay public to explain why these things are going on. And on top of that, a lot of the medical information, sadly, is incorrect, and I'll explain that in detail as we go on. So I wanted to provide a kind of a pragmatic, codified source for not so much toilet training, but after toilet training, when these problems develop, so parents could have a clue, you know, why is my kid wetting the bed? Why are they wetting themselves and acting like they don't even know they're going? And what causes it, and how can we fix it? Because so often this stuff is dismissed as, oh, the child is being a kid or the child has a small bladder, but no one's actually looking at the root cause, and there is pathology going on that can be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, you have children yourself, and obviously you have experienced this within your family itself, correct?
Oh, yeah. I have three little girls, and it's interesting. I don't know subconsciously if this is why I got into this field, and I don't know if it's too much information. But I remember as a kid not wanting to go to the bathroom in like public places or at school, and holding it. And luckily, I didn't have any issues with that, other than just, you know, trouble with bowel movements every once in a while. But then my oldest daughter, who looks kind of like me, you know, you can see the ones that favor you and the ones that favor your wife. Immediately when she started eating regular diet, became constipated, and I could see the issues develop. You know, I could see the future, you know, how bad it would be if we didn't jump on this, because I've seen it in my office so many times. And the poor kid is obsessed with her bowel movements now. She's like, she tells me every day she went to the bowel mm-hmm. movement, because she knows it makes me happy. It's like her that's like her first thing she tells me when I come home. But I can see, and it helped actually affect my views of the whole problem. It's affected them. Mm-hmm. I can see now how these issues developed. Before I had kids, I really didn't know that you could get severely constipated before toilet training, because we didn't really cover that. But now I see some kids are just very prone to dietary changes, and when that happens, they have trouble going. And if you don't jump on them, they can have a world of trouble later on.
Interesting. in reading your book, I mean, you're very passionate about this particular field of interest, and so it's quite exciting. How much research did you do before you write the book?
So, yeah, so interesting. For the past, like, I'd say 4 years, how we started originally is very interesting. So kids that come in my office with these problems are the technical term is dysfunctional elimination, okay? Mm-hmm. And the teaching of that has changed somewhat over the past 30 years. But in general, kids that have wedding or infections are said to have this dysfunctional elimination. And what that means is when they go to urinate or to have a bowel movement, they're accidentally or unintentionally not relaxing enough to let it all out. So they're keeping their sphincter too tight,
mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, they thought that this was a genetic inborn stricture or a blockage. And if you talk to any kids in my office with these problems, odds are their parents had the same problem and they had their urethra or their tube pee out of dilated as children. So that was the old therapy. They thought there was this little blockage in the tube and that would make it go better if you stretched it out. Mm-hmm. It worked sometimes, but for the wrong reasons. Then in the 90s, there was some research that said, you know what, maybe these kids, they're just, it's a learned behavior. It's because mm-hmm. they hold so long, they lose track of how to relax. So then the dilation of the tube was replaced with biofeedback therapy. You go see a physical therapist, and they teach you how to relax these muscles. And that's the mainstay of therapy. So I had in my office a lot of these kids. I was seeing most of them because my other partners had other areas of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I think that was a good thing because in most urologic practices in the country, they see nurse practitioners and physician's assistants who I'm not saying aren't qualified, but they tend to treat them in the cookbook manner that may be standard in the current teaching.
Right.
And so since I was seeing these kids myself and treating them with the standard therapies, I had physical therapists lined up, I had everything set up in the office, some of them weren't getting better at all. And I don't know what these kids do in other cities or states or other doctors, but, you know, to me it was very bothersome that I had nothing else to offer them. And then one child that I had to take care of ended up needing surgery for various reasons.
Wow.
And this child was on all the therapies that should be working, and they didn't. And when I did the surgery, I found that she was entirely full of stool. She was completely mm-hmm. constipated. Even though there was no report of it from the parents, and they were very conscientious, the child was actually on laxatives. And so this really bothered me. I started looking deeper into this. So about 4 years ago, I started getting x-rays on everybody that came into my office. And mm-hmm. I found a ridiculously high incidence of constipation, meaning not that they had rare bowel movements, but that
right.
they were full, that they were full of stool.
Mm-hmm.
That led to me to prepare to write a lot of papers on it, and when I pulled the old papers to cite, I found that this had already been discovered in the 1980s by Dr. Sean O'Regan,
mm-hmm.
and promptly misunderstood and forgotten about, basically. So then mm-hmm. I've been in contact with O'Regan, and part of the book was to re-educate people about Dr. O'Regan's research,
mm-hmm.
and I literally have about 5 papers ready to go on infections, and we have a series of 100 kids that we did prospectively measuring their constipation and how mm-hmm. it affects all sorts of voiding symptoms in children, including pain with urination, frequency of urination, and all these have been missed for years because no one looks for the bowel problem if the child's pooping regularly, and we've proven that that's insignificant. You really have to look with x-rays to find the problem.
Very, very interesting. How do children get constipated?
Yeah, so this is a combination, I think, of genetics and personality, really. So
mm-hmm.
if you take 20 kids and you feed them the same diet, some of them will have normal bowel movements, some of them won't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some are just more prone. I have 3 daughters, like I said. My oldest and my youngest, if you don't give them enough fiber, will get constipated immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And and what I mean by that is start having hard bowel movements.
Yeah.
And my middle one won't. So part of it is just your genetic makeup, and that is highly heritable. And almost always if you find a kid with that and you talk to the parents have the same problem. And the second is the personality of the child, whether or not they're so-called anal retentive, how unwilling they are to let it out. Because, you know, some kids may have a hard bowel movement and just kind of sit in the corner and grunt and get it out, whereas another one will be like, I'm not letting this thing out ever and hold on to it all day. And I do think a third is the age of toilet training, because the sooner you have the child having to actually go somewhere and take their clothes off to get it out, that's a little burden, a little higher burden of emptying, which you don't want. You want it as easy as possible to let the kid let it out, you know, because some kids may poop if they're playing in a diaper, but if they're playing and they have to poop not in diapers, they may not go. So I think that's a risk factor as well.
Very, very interesting. So what are the 11 signs of constipation in children?
Yeah, so we cover this in the book, and it's interesting because a lot of these get missed. I think the number one, and we put this number one in the book, is the extra large bowel movements. That's the most commonly mentioned by the parents, and often they say, you know, they had no idea that was a cause. So if your child's poop is just like, and it's like, you know, people always say, oh yeah, they're really big. You know, it's noticeably large for a child that small. That means that they've been holding until they couldn't hold it anymore, and they let this big, you know, this big piece out. So extra large bowel movements, even if they're every day, are worrisome, and you need to make sure that you address that. Obviously, hard bowel movements, everyone knows that one. That's an easy one, but it's typically the rarest of the findings. So if you have very hard bowel movements, which cause the child to, you know, have complaints or pain or cry when they're defecating, then that's definitely an issue. Infrequent bowel movements, again, that's your classic definition of constipation, a child that poops rarely. Again, that's understood by most people, but very rare in our clinic. Most kids that come in are pooping every day.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a child that's not pooping every day, that's a no-brainer, right? You need to be addressing that. Poop accidents. This is a huge one. One of the most severe cases of constipation is when you have what we call encopresis, which you're having, you lost control of your bowel movements and you're having accidents. And you don't know how many kids I see in my office where the parents say, you know, we're having some bedwetting. We don't know why. And I'll say, well, do you have any other problems? Well, sometimes he has poop accidents. And that should be universally a red flag. If any kid has poop accidents, they are severely, severely constipated, and that needs to be addressed. And for some reason that's being missed, so that needs to be stressed as well. Poop stained underwear, you know, we call that. A lot of kids have that, and again, you just blame it on being a kid. Oh, they're not wiping well. But if you think about it, if you get a bolus of stool into your rectum, if that makes sense, and then you let it out completely, you shouldn't even need to wipe that much. That's how ideally bowel movement should happen. But if you have a colon full of stool, like most kids, and you just break off a little piece when you have a bowel movement, and you don't have, and then the rest is still sitting in there, you can see how that would lead it almost impossible to wipe effectively and lead to staining, because you're not evacuating the rectum completely. So poop stain underwear should not be dismissed and should be evaluated as well. Interestingly, too, intermittently very loose stools can be a problem. If you have a child that's got, sometimes has rabbit pellet bowel movements or hard bowel movements intermittently with the very loose bowel movements, people will say, oh, he can't be constipated because it's liquid stool. That's not true, because if you have a clogged rectum, sometimes the less viscous stool, the liquidy stool, will pass around the balls and cause that. Intermittent belly pain. You know, we see kids in my office all the time for these problems. And I say, well, does he ever have belly pain? They go, oh, yeah, you know, he always has belly pain. We've been in the emergency room, and they did a CT scan for appendicitis. You know, it's the most common cause of belly pain by far in children is constipation. Pooping very, very frequently. Some kids come in and they say, parents say, oh, my child can't be constipated because they poop four times a day. And, you know, typically, again, healthy bowel movement is when you get a bolus of stool into the rectum about once a day and you let it out. But if you have a rectum full of stool that never gets completely empty, you can see how you may end up pooping several times a day because you always have something there. So if you're having a child that's pooping three, four, five times a day, you need to wonder, or, you know, I see this a lot in little girls. Every time they sit to pee, some poop falls out. That's not normal bowel patterns. You need to be worried about it. Another one that people miss a lot is kids that have trouble toilet training. If a three or four-year-old boy or girl, and you've been trying to toilet train, they just can't hold it, almost always that's a hidden constipation. And the colon is so dilated, it's affecting the bladder function. Another one, hiding to have bowel movements. a lot of kids that will go behind a couch or something. There's academic publications that have been linking that to constipation, so that needs to be addressed. And then finally, the obvious one for most people is bleeding with bowel movements or or itching or painful bowel movements that cause either from fissures or hemorrhoids. I see that a lot in kids, the parents. And even that sometimes shockingly is missed. They'll be like, well, you know, she poops every day, but there's some blood. Is that normal? And I think this pooping every day really throws people. So you got to, I'm trying to get that out of people's heads. And kids, it's a rarity to go less, you know, to go a week without pooping. They often go every day. But if you have these other symptoms, you need to be on the lookout for constipation.
Sounds like really there's no set patterns. I mean, it is and it's not, because if you are not paying careful attention, you can be thrown off, because the normal thought process that one has is like, well, if she's going 2 to 3 times a day, that's okay. If she's going once a day, that's okay. But then you still need to pay attention. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, and you know what? When we did our prospective study that we just kind of finished up enrolling patients, we gave every parent a questionnaire, two questionnaires, one on the bowel movement appearance and one on how often the kids have bowel movements. And these are standardized questionnaires that have been validated to pick up constipation. And almost always they're completely normal. And only when you get the X-ray so do you find it. So I think the lesson is, if you have a child with what we call irritative avoiding symptoms, so frequent peeing, urgent peeing, bedwetting, daytime wetting, pain with peeing, you need to assume they're constipated until you rule it out. And the best way to evaluate that is with an X-ray in my hands. And it's very easy, and it also allows for you, if you can't tell when they're constipated, how are you going to tell when you've effectively treated the constipation too, right? So you need follow-up as well to make sure you've done a good job.
You mentioned X-rays several times. Is there any particular right time or right age for the child to be X-rayed for constipation?
I think if you have a child that has, again, bad voiding symptoms, so they just can't toilet train, or they have bedwetting that can't get better, or they have accidents during the day, you could theoretically just start laxatives empirically, because odds are they have bowel issues. But what I've found is it's hard to get buy-in from the parents, right? Because no one believes this. Maybe when this is an accepted theory or whatever, then people will be on board. So what I'll do is I'll be like, you know, I think the child's constipated. Well, I'd like to try treatment. They're like, no, he's not. I say, well, let's get an X-ray. And it's useful for a baseline as well. So we'll get the X-ray, and then the poop is obvious. I can show it to the parents, and they're like, oh, my, you know, then they're like half embarrassed because they think it's like their fault, which it's not, you know, it's just something that happened. And so I'm like, no, that's what we're treating. Let's treat this. And we, and then we can follow up in a few months to make sure it's better, because I've been fooled so many times where the parents come in and say, you know, we've treated this, and you know, we think it's better, and you get an X-ray and it's not. So I don't think there's a particular age where you need to start it, but if you have a kid with these symptoms, then it's a good way to make sure the bowels are an issue. Although almost always they are.
Very interesting. So how do you unclog a child's colon?
Yeah, that's there's lots of different ways. So the landmark research done by Dr. O'Regan, he used, and this was eye-opening to me, he only used enemas. Can you believe that? And he told me no one ever complained. So that's interesting. Maybe in Canada they complain less, but it's very hard to do enemas. So I start off everyone with Miralax because it's easier. You can just drink it. And I'm not saying brand name Miralax. There's generic versions. It's basically polyethylene glycol, 3350. And everyone's gut reaction is, I want to do it with diet, or I want to, you know, add more fiber. My response is, good luck. It rarely works. You need big guns for these kids to have these bad problems. So Miralax works well in a subset of patients. And so we give that first, and we see how they do, and we follow up with an X-ray. Some kids, though, are so backed up distally at the end of the colon that the Miralax just washes past, and they just end up having diarrhea with no real improvement. So those kids then need something from below, and I've been using basically enemas or suppositories for those kids. And once you get past the kind of mental barriers to putting something up across the bottom, most parents that try it do fine with it, and the kids do fine as well, and they have much better results, so they're kind of a lot happier when they're doing that. So it's a combination of osmotic laxatives like Miralax and suppositories or enemas with close follow-up, and we start out with a Miralax with a very large dose, several capfuls over the weekend, and then we put them on a maintenance dose, and we keep them on for a long time. And many parents are very worried about being on laxatives, but really it's much better to be on something and have regular bowel movements and a non-dilated colon than to go through childhood with your colon stretched out, you know, to its capacity, causing pain.
One of the things that parents normally encounter is that, well, accident is normal up to a certain age. So is there any particular age that's normal and acceptable, or should we be looking at basically wide open here? There's no age limit in terms of the problems that you're talking about.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're trying to overcome with the book, and I'm trying to overcome with a lot of that, is that because I'll see kids and they'll have accidents and they'll be called normal, and then years later they're having worse problems, you know. So really, no accident is normal. Maybe right when the toilet trained, a kid may wait too long, and if it's once a year or something, twice a year, okay, they got stuck somewhere where they were scared to go to the bathroom or something. But think about yourself. I mean, as adults, you have to be locked somewhere away for a long time to not be able to hold your urine. So what the sign is for a kid, if they're having accidents, is that their bladder is overactive, right? They're not able to hold it a reasonable amount of time, because usually the urge is so bad that you'll find a bathroom no matter what you're doing. But what happens to these kids is they have less of a warning because their bladder's overactive, because maybe they're constipated, or because they've been chronically holding their bladder. So this accidents are early warning signs that you're getting to a place where maybe they can't control it. And if you would jump on it at that time, then it would be much easier to fix than if you waited and then a year later they're having daily accidents and maybe poop accidents, and then everything's... Because the pathology that changes in the bladder does not happen overnight. And if you let it progress, then you're going to need that much more time to fix it in the future, if you follow me. The answer is that accidents are not normal, and they should be addressed and treated aggressively.
Very interesting. What are some of the symptoms of chronic pee holding? Because that would be easier to detect than probably constipation.
Yeah, I think so. And so I have a lot of parents who come in, and they notice these things, but they just don't act on them because they're not sure. I guess because I think a big problem is that parents often put their own views on the child, you know, and they think, well, you know, why would they do that? It doesn't make sense. So early on, I hear a lot of stories where kids are training, and once they're trained, they'll pee very rarely, you know, just obviously rarely. Like maybe they won't. Lots of kids come into my office and they said the parents say they never pee in the morning. They just get up and go to school, you know. and some of them may not pee for the first time of the day till after the school bus brought them home. So obvious holding, your child's, you know, when they're first trained, they often have a compliant bladder because they haven't been holding. So they can hold it a long time, but that doesn't mean they should. So you should encourage regular emptying. And then you need to look for signs. Like girls will... The potty dance is, you know, universal. Everyone does the potty dance. Mm-hmm. And I really get kind of mad when I see diaper companies making fun of the potty dance. Like it's something funny, you know, because it's really not. It's a kid causing damage to their bladder. So if you see the potty dance, you know, and I've never had a kid doing the potty dance be asked by their parents if they need to go to the bathroom and answer yes. They always say no. Mm-hmm. So if you see those signs, you just take them to the bathroom. Specifically with girls, girls tend to like curtsy or squat or sit on their heels, you know, and that's a holding behavior. Boys tend to grab at their privates, so, and people explain that away all the time, like, oh, he's just playing, or he's just, it. And the kids even, because I have some nephews that do it all the time, and I'll be like, hey, you know, go to the bathroom. Like, I don't need to, and you know they do, otherwise they wouldn't do it. So you need to look for these subtle signs, and if you really keep an eye out, they're obvious, but it's also easy to dismiss them. So I would encourage parents to encourage children to go to the bathroom regularly, look for holding behaviors, and then prompt them when you see those.
And these are universal actions that the child is taking, so it's not something like you were saying where you could deduce it in a different way. It's a natural posture that they're taking because they are reacting to their body, correct?
Exactly, and they don't want. And to them, it's more... it's a better idea for them to maybe hold it by squatting on their heel than to go to the bathroom because maybe they're in the middle of something. And I guess another thing to mention is that if you've always had a child rushing to the bathroom, right, every time they need to go with a mad dash, that's worrisome, right, because why are they having to rush? Either they waited too long or their bladder is already changing and becoming overactive, and they have less warning. So that's another. You should, it's not the, going to the bathroom should be like, oh, I gotta go, and they walk to the bathroom. It shouldn't be like, if I don't get there right now, I'm gonna have an accident.
Are there solutions to this problem?
Yeah. So it's two simple solutions. Two simple, because you only have a bowel and the bladder, right? There's no other areas. You need to make sure they're having regular bowel movements, which are small and mushy. So basically, 2 centimeters should be the widest bowel movement, and it should have the consistency of a milkshake or hummus, or pick-up food analogy. But it should be way mushier than you think and way smaller than you think. But if you get on the right laxative, you can get there easily. So you need to make sure the bowels are regular, and you need to make sure that they actually got empty. So if you fix the bowels and you're still having problems, an x-ray is in order to make sure that it's actually working. And the second is to make sure that they're voiding on a schedule. You know, when they wake up in the morning, everyone has to pee when they wake up in the morning. It's a fact of life because you've produced, you know, 8 hours of urine. So there's no excuse not to urinate when you wake up in the morning, and then encourage your child to go regular during the day. Schools, you know, we have a whole chapter on schools in the book. They often, you know, they make breaks for kids, but a lot of times the kids don't use the breaks, and then when they want to go, they can't go. You have to encourage your child to go regularly at every opportunity. And also, I think, and this is controversial, but I've got so much data showing it. There's no rush to get kids out of diapers. The sooner you get them out of diapers, the sooner they're going to start deciding whether they go to the bathroom or not, and I guarantee they're going to make a bad decision. So if you can let them sit in the diaper and pee, you know, whenever they want to, you're going to lead to bladder growth. An added benefit is if it's one of those kids that's prone to constipation, and they're in diapers, it's much easier to treat it because you can just give them laxatives till they have diarrhea and get it cleaned out and not worry about having accidents. So I cannot stress enough that keeping kids in diapers is not dangerous, and it will be beneficial in terms of developing bladder, normal bladder function.
Your book also discussed the psychological aspects of this problem. So what are some of the psychological aspects of wetting?
Yeah, I used to always tell parents, I would give them what I just gave you, you know, the two kind of have them pee on time and poop on time. And then a lot of parents would come back and be like, yeah, they won't go. And then I was like, oh, I kind of have enough for you, you know? And so there's a whole component of this that is parenting, I guess, 101, or how to get a child to do something that they don't want to do. And it's the same as, you know, me trying to get my daughters to eat their vegetables, or go to take a bath. It's very difficult to get a child to buy into sometimes. And so, again, that's why I go back to maybe training later is easier, because then you don't have to worry about it so often. But once you do need a regimented program to help with that. Sometimes child psychologists can help. We had a child psychologist contribute a chapter on this, and she goes over a couple different things. She basically, it is important that you discuss what's going on with the child. Sometimes you can use metaphors or examples of how it's dangerous to be full all the time. You can blow up a balloon and see, like, oh, if you keep on blowing it up, it'll pop. Or some people use socks as an example of the bowel, and if you get really full, you know, it could be dangerous. So you want to give them some information so they understand that you're doing this for a reason. If you get the if you go see a doctor for it, you can have the doctor talk to the child specifically. I see the more people that talk to the kids about it, the more odds they're going to buy in. You can have, like, you know, me tell a kid 10 times to not hold their pee, and then one of my nurses tells them and they listen. You know, it's different people respond differently to different advice. So make sure that the doctor is addressing it to the child as well, so they can kind of buy into their therapy. I think positive reinforcement is very important in any kind of, you know, childhood task. Negative reinforcement has caused the problem, right? Because when they pooped, it hurts. They stopped going. Or when they had to go to the bathroom, they missed a TV show or they missed a game. So discomfort caused the habits. So what you want to do is have benefit from those behaviors, because in the end, we're all human beings, are all the same, right? We avoid pain and gravitate towards benefits. So if you can make it so that when they do these things, they get some benefit, then I think that's very important. And also, you don't want to over stress about the problem and put kind of extra kind of psychological strain on the whole family, because it can be very frustrating. And so I think the best you can do is understand that this is a problem that is due to the child's bladder. It's not the child just doesn't want to go to the bathroom. There's actually problems with them physiologically. And so if you can give them the right structure to get better and be calm about it, and they can stick to the program, they will get better eventually. It just takes time. And if you can encourage that with a child as well, saying, you know what, we're doing these things to make you get better. It takes some time, and you will get there eventually. And also, you can make it fun. You know, sometimes if they have books or other things they can do around the potty, so that when they go there, it's not, can I get there and get out as quick as I can, so that they have some encouragement to actually go to the bathroom and do it. And I see it in my own daughter, you know, that's, I've kind of stressed this so much that she now feels rewarded or feels proud when she does go to the bathroom appropriately. And I think that's not such a bad thing. It may sound a little weird to some people, but I think it's beneficial that she knows that she needs to go to the bathroom regularly and not hold it. And when she does, she's going to be rewarded. And even if it's just a good job or attagirl or whatever. And then make sure they do have some independence and feel like they're accomplishing something on their own when they do it. So some autonomy, maybe they get to decide which potty they use or what underwear they wear. So it's just kind of a team effort, you know, with low stress, kind of the soft sell every day. You know, you don't want to be overbearing with it. And just introduce the program, offer positive reinforcement, and encourage them that, okay, you had an accident this time. We're going to get better. Just keep on working on it, because they can't get discouraged.
Very interesting. You talk a lot about how constipation causes all the sequence of events. They all link together. And, of course, that links to bedwetting. For parents, when they look at bedwetting, they don't necessarily tie that into constipation. Are there reasons for kids to just wet the bed that is not related to constipation?
Yeah, so there's three identified causes of bedwetting in the literature. One is overproduction of urine at night. So if you had too much urine, so some kids have hormonal imbalances or other disorders that cause them to just overproduce urine at night. So if you produce a ton of urine at night, you may have bedwetting, and we see that in rare cases. Secondly is sleep arousal issues. If you're just a deep sleeper or have sleep apnea or something, it puts you in a state of sleep that makes you more likely to have accidents and not wake up. So sleeping is a problem. And then the third is bladder overactivity of any cause, but typically bladder overactivity is most commonly caused by constipation. My whole point is, before all these other theories and work's been done, Dr. O'Regan proved that 86% of kids had constipation as a cause, you know. And there's never been a study that didn't show treating constipation helped. Never. Now, and if you improve the bladder capacity by treating the constipation, then the other two causes become less of an issue. You know, you can drink a lot before bed if your bladder's large, and you can sleep very deeply for very long if your bladder's large. So it's the most important cause. And also, the data for those two causes is equivocal. There are studies that show that children have antidiuretic hormone abnormalities, and you give them desmopressin, and they do better. Some studies don't show that. So also, there's some studies that show kids with bedwetting have sleep disorders. Some studies show they don't. So I think what really triggers all that research, it's a shame, but it's like we're all humans.
Yeah.
When you have a kid that's wetting the bed, what do parents see? They see a kid that's sleeping, sound asleep, in a big pile of pee. So it looks like this kid's completely out of it. They can't wake up. And when they pee, they're peeing gobs of urine. So those are the two, it's just a little suspicious to me that the two most commonly treated things are things that seem like they should be causing it, right? And things that seem like they're the cause are not always the main cause on the surface. So I think it's what I do now is I treat constipation first, and 80% of kids get better. And if the 20% that don't get better, I do use a bedwetting alarm, and they can basically be trained to wake up when they need to pee. And it works in everybody. But what's frustrating for me is I get all these patients coming in and everyone's given a pill to make less pee at night by their
right.
And that's not really treating the problem effectively. That's just throwing a medicine at the problem. If you really look for it, you'll find constipation in most kids, and if you address it, they can get better very rapidly.
Looks like they're just addressing the symptoms, and those pills are just taking care of the symptoms but not the root cause of the problem.
Yeah, and it's a shame, but everyone's busy and it's easy to do, and sometimes it helps, so why not? But I'm trying to change that whole way of thinking and say, you know, it's classic. If you got a if you got a boat with a hole in it sinking, you don't just bail the water, you plug the hole, right? So you got to get to the cause
right.
of the problem, and the cause is almost always constipation. And it makes a lot of sense, and there's the more kids I see. You know, I see so many kids that are 12, 13 years old, 14, 15. I saw an 18-year-old last week. And they've been wetting for 10 years, you know,
wow.
or more. And it could be, and that's, you know, 10 times 365. How many days of that is wetting? And that's can be fixed sometimes in a week with enemas. So it's shame when it's ignored because it's an easily fixable problem. And we don't know what kind of manifestation this is having on their adult life.
Mm-hmm.
How many people have irritable bowel syndrome or bowel problems or bladder problems due to this? And actually, there was a paper published last month that we attached on our blog that mentioned if you had bedwetting as a child, you're more likely to have incontinence as an adult. And that makes sense. So I think it's very frustrating for me when people treat bedwetting as a stage of development,
right.
not as a medical problem. I did an interview for a Canadian newspaper or TV station, and they should have known better because it's the home of Dr. O'Regan. But the other doctor they interviewed said, oh, everyone outgrows it. Let's not medicalize this problem.
Right.
And that's really flawed thinking because some kids don't outgrow it. And some kids get a lot worse before they get better. And it's not without trauma or stress in the child and the family. So if you can treat it by, say, doing a simple x-ray and giving them some laxatives, you know, why not?
Right. Very true. Is there a correlation between ADHD and bedwetting?
Yes, there is. There's a strong correlation for all dysfunctional elimination traits and ADHD, and it makes perfect sense, right? This is another thing. It just makes intuitive sense. What causes all these problems, right? A kid that doesn't have the attention or the desire or the patience to go to the bathroom when they need to, right? And what do ADHD kids? They have low focus. So who's most likely to put off peeing or pooping, or when they do go pee or poop for the least amount of time possible? That's the kid with ADHD. So the actual numbers are about 10 times the incidence of these problems in kids with ADHD. So it's very important, not only if you're treating these problems, that you make sure they go to the bathroom and have regular bowel movements, but also to treat the ADHD, because we see that that can be a contributor to the habits that led to the problem in the first place. And so, you know, it's hard to sit in the bathroom for 5 minutes if your mind's racing on all the stuff you want to do. So that's why it needs to be addressed early on as well.
Very interesting. As a urologist, why do kids get urinary tract infections?
This is another, and I'm not trying to come across like a know-it-all or anything, but it's another area of significant misunderstanding with people. So I see kids with infections all the time. They come in, and what are they doing? Usually girls, and they're wiping front to back, and they're not taking baths. That's their big therapy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those two things have nothing to do with infections. Urinary tract infections are caused by constipation, holding of urine, and sometimes irritated perineal skin. So it makes perfect sense if you think about it this way. What causes a urinary tract infection? A urinary tract infection is caused by bacteria from the colon that get into the bladder, and the bladder is, and they're held there too long, and then when they empty them, by the time they empty, infection started. So if you have constipation, you have a large amount of stool collected right by the urethra in girls, and so that provides a source of bacteria. Once the bacteria get in the bladder and they have a few hours to sit there, if the child's not peeing, you have an infection. And we found some interesting things in our research. Number one, if you treat the constipation, the infections go away. Dr. O'Regan proved that in the 80s. Number two, we rarely see infections in kids prior toilet training. So even if they have early constipation, if they pee regularly, the infections don't happen. So holding is very important as well. And number three, almost all girls pee with their legs together. You follow me? The urine does not go directly into the toilet. Some goes up into the vagina, drips out later and causes skin irritation. And that skin irritation leads to major issues and can lead to upgrowth of the bacteria that cause infections And so those three habits are causative. So the therapies include treating the constipation, making sure their skin on their bottom is clean and dry and free of irritation, and number three is making sure they're drinking plenty and voiding regularly so you can prevent all three of those causes. What they drink and how they wipe, much less significant than those three things.
Very interesting. Where can someone go to get your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Yeah, so we have a website with a blog. It's www.itsnoaccident.net, and we try to keep that updated. And also on that website, we have a link to our Facebook page and also to sites to purchase the book if people are interested. So it's www.itsnoaccident.net.
One of the interesting things you wrote in your book, which I really liked, the very first part, you talk about how to use the book. And like everybody else, people want to take shortcut. Oh, I have this problem. Let me just go to chapter 6 or chapter 7.
Exactly.
So tell us a little bit about that, since you want to sort of give people an idea when they get the book to really know and understand how everything works.
Yeah, I think that the introduction is very important to kind of get the story, because I think people find a lot of familiar maybe sounding stories in there. And also the first chapter that introduces the general problems that we're discussing, the potty problems how this has become an epidemic and our theories of why this happened, and also the research behind it, so it makes an interesting story. And then I really, really, really encourage everyone to read the chapter on constipation, because again, I believe that's the root cause of this. And really the biggest problem is that I find in treating these kids is effectively making sure the constipation is treated appropriately. And what I mean by that is making sure that the rectum has been evacuated and it's restored its normal tone. So if you can read those three chapters, and then you can go on to the specific problem you have, whether it's bedwetting or daytime accidents or infections as well. But the first three chapters are very important.
Very interesting. How has writing It's No Accident impacted you personally?
I guess good and bad ways. I was thinking the ideas were sound and good, so just putting them out there, they would be accepted maybe more readily. I didn't really expect a lot of the academic kind of, a lot of people would go to, parents will go ask their doctor for an x-ray, and they'll be like, we're not getting it, your child's not constipated. So I think I've been jaded a little bit about how the world works and how maybe new ideas are accepted or not accepted.
Right.
And I'm also, but I'm also learned a lot more about how the work it takes to maybe get a new idea out there. So I'm trying to get better at having a clearer message, more succinct message, because you can get, if you have so much that you want to say and so much passion about it, then sometimes you can confuse people by just sprouting out random information. So I've toned down our message a little bit and learned a little bit about how conveying that to people, maybe in a more acceptable way. Because I guess in the end, if the message doesn't get out there, it's kind of on me, because I'm the one that's trying to get it out there. So I'm trying to become a more effective spreader of my message. But that's a neat thing. And kind of more, and I understand everyone wants to be, it's good to have a healthy skepticism for new ideas.
Right.
So that's fine. So I got to find a way where I can maybe introduce these ideas so people aren't so skeptical and maybe more willing to accept them.
Well, some people don't like to be challenged too. That's the problem. And that's human nature. If you are very open and understanding and look at ideas as form of opportunity to learn, then it's okay. But you'll find that a lot of people are close-minded, because if it's not their idea, then it's not an idea.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then you have like a 56-year-old pediatrician that's been treating bedwetting some way their entire life, and to have a young buck tell them that they've been doing it wrong, that's necessarily appealing story.
I like what you have done with your book as well in terms of nutrition, because you have a very thorough approach to nutrition. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so it's no secret that we've got a problem with obesity and food issues in the country. High levels of childhood obesity. We have type 1 I mean, type 2 diabetes now coming on in children. So this, I think one of the issues that we think caused this epidemic of poly problems is the dietary issues. We have kids eating processed foods, low fiber, and again, I can't throw rocks at anyone because when I feed my kids, it's hard to get them to eat the right diet as well. But it's important that people understand that, and as a society, maybe we make it easier for kids to get this food and find ways to make sure parents know that nutrition is important on many levels, and it also it affects elimination because you get this food that's completely processed out of a package. The fiber content's minimal. So if we can get the whole point is hopefully to encourage more whole food eating, more fresh food eating. And I know it's difficult, and I'm as guilty as the next person in terms of just trying to make up the difference with Miralax. Some people don't like Miralax just because it is so effective that people almost give up on dietary changes. And I don't want that to happen. So I do stress the use of laxatives, but also the use of dietary changes to maintain these problems. Because although you may need laxatives to treat the initial event, it's helpful to have a healthy diet to maintain once a problem is treated.
Very interesting. And you do cover exercise programs for working up muscles. That was very interesting. And then, of course, you offer strategies in terms of having kids stick to the program. So let's briefly talk a little bit about that, because your book offers a complete package, and that's what I really like about your book.
Yeah, so going back to what we were talking about originally, there's all this theory that, again, there's this learned behavior to keep the pelvic muscles contracted while you're voiding, and that's problematic. And some people blame it on posture. Some people blame it on just kind of habit developing, because it seems like in countries where they have maybe different toilets or they use squatting to evacuate, there's less of these issues, and that's an interesting area for study as well. So the physical therapist, if you don't have time to go see a physical therapist to kind of help your child learn to relax their pelvic muscles and do these things, we have some exercises that include stretches and so forth that can encourage the same type of things that can be done at home. It's not perfect. It's not a cure-all, but it helps develop maybe a more open pelvis, relaxing. There's a lot of components of core strength to going to the bathroom appropriately. You know, some kids, I see kids with maybe medical problems with weak cores, and they have more issues with constipation and voiding problems. So we basically provide some exercises where parents can do things at home to encourage bladder and pelvic relaxation so the child can have more regular bowel movements. And then the strategies is the chapter that the psychologist helped us touched on earlier in terms of how can you get a child to do something maybe they don't want to do. And that is a trick in and of itself. But if you use those strategies at home, again, what we try to do is replace maybe some specialists, because not everyone's going to have time to go see a urologist and a GI doctor and a nutritionist and a physical therapist and a psychologist, you know. But in a perfect world, there would be maybe a uniform setting where they could all help you. And there's some dysfunctional elimination centers. And at WAKE, we try to kind of coordinate this where you'll see all these specialists and give you all the tools you need to fix this problem. But if you can't do that, then the book provides a little bit of expertise from all those fields so that you can combine it all so that your child is having a good diet, they are doing the exercises, they are using strategies to help them stick with the plan, and they are going to the bathroom regularly with soft bowel movements. So put all together, you have a much higher rate of success than if you did each one individually.
It's a wonderfully written book. Like I said before, it should be a must-read for all parents out there, because it will answer all your questions with regards to certain things that you will notice in your own child that otherwise you would have taken for granted.
Yes, I think so, yeah. And the message I'm trying to get out there primarily is that these things are not normal and that sometimes the cause is not what you may appear, and that's and meaning constipation, which may be hidden. So I'm hoping people will have an open mind to kind of accept that, and I think they'll have a lot of benefit if they do.
Yeah, very interesting. And the good news is that you do have parents that got their child involved with your research, I mean, as it is evident in the book. And I think that's important, too, because rather than, like you were saying, this is based on what I've worked on and so forth, you have parents actually participating and showing the result from it.
Yeah, the proof is in the pudding, and that's why hopefully as slowly as parent, because so many kids have this problem. I get emails from all over the place, and I get, my clinic's full every day of kids' cases like this. I'm amazed where they're coming from, because it's a new kid every time. But I think as each case goes on and it kind of goes from parent to parent, then these ideas will be more accepted because everyone wants their kid to stop wetting the bed. Everyone wants their kid to stop having accidents. And so if you find at least a solution that works, I think it'll catch on.
That's fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living, which is a little bit different, you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, I thought a lot about this, and I think what's been helpful for me for this is to, and I think the basic thing is basically to ask the simple questions. And what I mean by that is this, for example. So how did I do my research on urinary tract infections? There was a saying that constipation causes urinary tract infections. Okay, people knew that forever. But no one asked why, right? There's no, if you look in the literature, there's no good explanation. Why? And so that's how I started my project. I was like, why would having poop in your colon or not pooping regularly cause infections? And it didn't make any sense until I started getting x-rays. Because if you have poop, your colon's a large organ. If you have poop at the very beginning of it, backed up, that doesn't cause infections. If you have poop anywhere else, the only time it can cause infection is if you have a large amount of it accumulated at the very end. And so that led to me to my understanding that, wow, it's not really constipation, it's accumulated stool.
No.
So if you take a fact and you ask pointed, direct questions about that fact, then I think you find the answer much clearly. But I think that people oftentimes just accept something like, well, sure, constipation causes bedwetting. I mean, constipation causes infections because we've seen kids with constipation and infections. But why does it cause infections, and how do we prevent it? And so that led me to the research. So asking these questions is very important in all aspects of life, and in medicine, very much so. If a kid comes in with bedwetting, you got to ask yourself, why is this kid wetting the bed? Why can their bladder not hold the pee where another other kids could? And looking for that specific cause on all these areas of interest is what led me to doing my research and writing the book.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. It's the curiosity concept approaching from why things to work the way they are. So very interesting. Any final thoughts about it's no accident?
I think also the whole concept of the simplest answer, maybe sometimes, like the Occam's razor, like the shortest point but too long, because I have a lot of kids will come in with wetting and they don't feel anything when they wet themselves because they're just kids. So people will make up all sorts of explanations why the child's wetting himself. They'll say they have a sensory processing disorder or they'll have all this stuff. And when you fix the actual cause, they get better and all of a sudden they can feel it. So it's much better to find a simple, direct cause than something non-specific, or vague. So I stress that for the field. And the other thing for the book is make sure if you have a child evaluated for constipation that someone that knows what they're doing gets the x-ray and looks at it. I have had so many pediatricians get an x-ray, read the radiology report that says normal x-ray, and say, see, your child is not constipated. And then they send me the x-ray and I look at it and there's 10 centimeters of stool in the rectum. Not always, because it's a new idea, people don't always look for poop as an abnormal thing, right? They consider stool to be normal. So it's not always red. So you need to make sure that someone knows what they're doing, that understands our research, looks at the x-ray, and then addresses it, because it can be missed.
Very interesting. What is your website address again that people could follow you and read your blog?
Sure, www.itsnoaccident.net.
Any particular things you guys are planning for now to the end of the year with regards to the books?
We're trying to do just as many blogs and promotions as we can. We're trying to get some, national TV appearances. I think that the problems we cover in the book are so widespread and so common. And I think if people can understand that these are treatable problems and they're not just something you need to accept, then we'll get much more public awareness and maybe get the word out. So my main goal is to like I said before, is to get my message honed and to get my message out any means necessary. So I thank you for your interview, and anything I can do on TV or on the internet or on radio to get the message out and spread word to word, that's my number one goal. And that's another thing I learned from writing is how much legwork that is. It's a lot of legwork. But I've kind of been doing this for a few months now. I guess I'm getting a little bit better at my message, and I still have a lot of energy to do it, so I'm going to keep doing that for the rest of the year and try to get this out to as many kids as we can.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Steve, you have a wonderful message. Thank you also for giving us the wonderful recipe for living with regards to asking questions of why certain things happen. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me in 2 weeks on Tuesday, May 29th. My guest will be author Avery Ames. Her new novel, The Long Quiche Goodbye, is the first book of the Quiche Sharp Mystery Series. For additional information about this show, future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Dr. Steve, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.